his back wrong somewhere along the way. Maybe I should apologize in advance. Just get that out of the way. To say, well, I'm a crass Canadian and I don't know what I'm going to say and I only have the experience I have. But in my experience, what are you sorry for? See, we'll start the therapy part right away. Exactly what... Exactly what is it you are sorry for? Oh, you didn't. But if you want to try later, you can. So you all have a right hand, do you? Come up here. Get up here. Which is your best ear? Sit where you can hear the best, okay? You can sit up here, too. Y'all have a right hand, do you? You're getting used to this now, aren't you? Does it feel different every night? Some of you notice? What kind of energy, what kind of feeling does your right hand have? What about your right shoulder? Can you feel your right shoulder? What kind of feeling does your right shoulder have? Is there tension there? Does it feel rounded? Does it feel relaxed? Does it feel larger or smaller than the left shoulder? Right side of your face, does it feel somewhere on the right side of your face that it's kind of like a mask? The skin feel tighter around the eyes, around the mouth? Just feel how that feels and then go back to feeling your right hand. What kind of energy is your right hand? Your left hand, you all have a left hand? Feel the energy of your left shoulder, the left side of your body, your left rib cage. Have a sense of how that feels, the left side of your face. What does it feel like? Go back to your left hand. Do they feel like they're different energy, your left hand and your right hand? Do they? Sort of point them at each other. Can you feel a sense of warmth or pressure or something between your hands? Focus on the palms and see if you can feel kind of a warmth and a pressure between them. If you don't, just bring your hands together until you do. When you got that sense, then take your fingertips and bring your fingertips together really slowly. Then bring the heels of your hands together. I bet you didn't know your hands had heels. And just bring your little fingers together. And take that energy and just hold it in front of your heart center. Feel that energy between your hands, held in front of your heart. And image that there's a river of gold light going up your spine. And it represents every moment of aspiration you've ever had. Every moment where you've seen great beauty or you've had an understanding of something. Every moment where you've been in suffering and you wish to be free of it, or you've seen someone suffering or you've heard of suffering and you wish that it would end. Every moment where your consciousness soared to something beyond yourself. It's like a huge river of gold light moving up your spine. There's a gold light above your head. You hold a sense of that, that's aspiration. You hold a sense of that movement. And you make a statement about your own personal aspiration. When I do this, I say a Buddhist formula. You can say whatever you want. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Sadhu. And just let it go. Welcome and thank you for coming. You don't mind if I pace around a bit when I talk now and then, do you? Is that okay? I promise not to step on too many people. So tonight's topic is meditation and therapy healing the wounds. It's an interesting subject. It's an interesting topic. Because there's a lot of different motivation that people have for meditating. And I think it's very important to first understand that there are many different reasons that people meditate. Sometimes people meditate because they would like not to have too much suffering in this life. Have you noticed that? Have you? Vacuum land? Okay. Thanks. Sometimes people meditate because they like to get away from this life. You notice that? A lot of people do that. And sometimes people meditate so that at the end of this life they will have a happier birth. There are all kinds of reasons. Some people, I've met people who meditate so that they can win lotteries. You can do that. There's really very little you can't do. Really very little you can't do. The real question isn't what you can do. The question is, what can you accept? Because I think the spiritual path is not necessarily getting anything. And I think if you look at the life of Shakyamuni Buddha, that's exemplified. There are a lot of things about modern-day Buddhism. That's to say, Buddhism as it has existed for the last 2,000 years. As opposed to the last 2,500 years. I call last 2,000 years modern day Buddhism. That I am not particularly fully accepting of. But overall, I think most of that teaching is fairly trustworthy. And if you look at the story of the Buddha's search before he was the Buddha, when he was just Gautama, it's very clear that he started his spiritual path because he wanted something to offer to his family, to his loved ones. And he had nothing to offer except position and money. Now, for some people, they want to be able to offer money or freedom from worry or health or things like that, right? Those things are all possible. But really, from the point of view of Buddhist meditation, those are all lesser motives for meditating. So this is very curious. This is a very curious idea because in Buddhism you get this very interesting, in the Vajrayana school in particular, you get this very strong stress on how important is the guru. The guru is so important. Why is the guru important? Why do you think? Whoops.
Clearer being.
Sorry? Yeah.
Part of self-pursuit.
Dismiss what?
Mirror.
Mirror.
I'm saying it's part of dissolving the ego is to actually see. More immersion than you are.
Yeah. This is all, yeah, one of the ways of describing the value of a guru is very curious. I'd like you just to bear it in mind for the moment before you just jump up and down and say, yes, but, okay? Is that a deal? Will you just bear it in mind before you... One of the definitions of a guru is someone who is not really concerned about whether or not you're happy in this life. They're not impressed with happiness. They're more interested in awakening than in happiness. So in terms of happiness, position, they don't care for you like your parents would care for you. They don't care whether you go to university or get a good job. Unless that is a path for your awakening. So it's a different kind of care. Now that's pretty interesting, isn't it? What do you think, Vacuum Land? Some of you haven't heard me speak before, and I should explain that I suffer from an inferiority complex. And I need a lot of reassurance. So I keep asking you see. But if I'm afraid I'm not going to get it, then I ask you by suggesting that maybe I feel like I'm speaking to a vacuum. So I call you Vacuum Land, you see. So all that means is I need your reassurance. So from the Vajrayana point of view, Vajrayana Buddhism, there are different schools of Buddhism. Do you know this? Do you know this stuff? Do any of you not know this stuff? So this is interesting to you? Okay. From a Vajrayana point of view, which is one of the schools of Buddhism, where what is stressed is how you should train yourself so that once the experience called arahat is attained, you keep working. Or otherwise known as what is stressed is the bodhisattva vow, as opposed to the Theravadin tradition, where what is stressed is the experience of awakening. Do you see the difference? One stresses the experience, get there. The other one, all the way through, from the beginning of the training, says, when you get there, don't forget to. That's really one of the strongest differentiations between the two schools, two main schools. And according to the Vajrayana tradition, a guru is one who loves you more than your parents ever could. Because your parents' great concern and care is to make sure you are happy in this life. Do your parents care about how whoever you were was in a previous life or will be in the next? Don't have time to think about those things. You got to buy new shoes. You got to make dinner. Forget about next lifetime. It isn't their job. It isn't their role to do that. You see that? Now, one of the things I think is true of therapy is therapy... Uh-oh, I'm going to get it for this. I know I'm going to get it for this. Oh, I'm going to say it anyway. Therapy is really concerned with you being happier in this life. Do you agree? Why don't you agree? You don't think it has a name?
I think any technique can be used, any purpose. The therapy can be used to go beyond the aim of just simply being happy in this life.
Do you think it is used for that aim? Generally speaking.
Generally speaking, no. But then generally speaking, people who come to
Do you think that people who take the Bodhisattva vow or are aware of the potential of meditation might be more, that it is more clear that that is more than just one lifetime in meditation groups than it is in therapy groups? Okay. I think that most of the therapists that I have spoken to and the therapy books that I have read, the aim seems to be to that someone function well and happily in society. Generally speaking, would you agree with that definition? Yeah. What?
I'm just responding with tension, possible disagreement.
I think people come to therapy generally because there's some level of dissatisfaction that they'd like addressed in some sort of way.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if all therapists go about trying to resolve that which has brought the person along, but maybe give them some understanding of a way of being with the problem. You know, coming maybe to know it a little better, to understand it a little better. That doesn't necessarily mean that the person's necessarily happier.
Yeah.
But I think there's a big school of therapy around that, at 9 years.
Yeah, there is. Did you hear, Richard?
No.
Do you want to paraphrase or do you want to say it again?
You can paraphrase.
Are you sure?
Yes.
I'm going to paraphrase him and he'll correct me. Okay? Richard is suggesting that there is quite a large school of therapy where people come because they have a difficulty, a problem. And the work of the therapist is particularly to make them aware, give them techniques and make them aware of how to live with that problem without necessarily being happier. Have a sense of being able to handle the problem.
Or come to understand it a little better.
Understand the problem. Yeah. Yeah. Would you agree?
Yes.
I
can understand what Richard's saying about the therapist side, but I believe from my own experience that that is a way that I've worked, but it's only ever motivated by this is causing me a lot of distress, and if I understand it better, I'll be out of the distress, or I will somehow be happier because I'll be dealing with it better. I mean, the situation doesn't change, but I am calmer around it, and as a result of that karma, that increased karma, I am happier.
Yeah.
So I've got a really difficult parent.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. And it is motivated by not wanting to continually be reacting to the situation, which it brings me unhappiness when I start reacting.
Exactly.
So I still see.
So the awareness and the way of naming it and so forth does actually cause less stress and less suffering. I would agree. I would agree totally with that.
So, I mean, as a therapy, not as a therapist, that's...
As a therapy, that's your experience.
That's
I would agree. I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
So is there that much difference, though, between seeking to avoid suffering and trying to be happy?
I think there is, you know, but only because from a meditation point of view. Like, from a meditation point of view, if you are in a state of suffering, you have choices to make. If the state of suffering is causing really unwholesome energy to arise, mind states to be triggered in your consciousness, then you do whatever you can, whatever techniques are necessary to remove yourself from that state of suffering. That's number one, and that's basically the therapy kind of stuff. Okay? Give yourself some maneuvering point, number one. Number two, if there is suffering happening, you watch your reaction and get insight into the mind and how quickly it wishes to respond to stimuli. Okay? You try to see what is it that is moving. Okay? So you use it for insight into mind itself. That's number two. And that's more the Theravadin type of technique. Number three, if there is suffering happening, you open your heart to feel that, you become aware of that suffering, and then you consider that this is the suffering not different than all beings are feeling. And you have a sense of compassion and a desire to be able to do something for the sake of all beings. And that directly arises, that state of compassion directly arises from not fighting your suffering. And that's the Mahayana path of working with suffering. So there's three very different techniques, aren't they?
It still appears to me. Like,
can everybody hear my dear friend Maya here?
It still does appear to be an act of sophistry, though. I mean, you're changing the language slightly, but the process seems to be very, very similar.
Do you think that those three are the same?
I think that you're approaching it from a different angle, but I suspect that a lot of the things that are happening are very similar.
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand. What do you mean? What's similar?
Well, each of these are processes. I mean, they involve, say, a slightly different sort of worldview or a slightly different technique for approaching it, but essentially they're all geared towards looking at what's happening and responding to that.
That's right. That's right. They are all geared with that, to that. The other option is to not look at what's happening. Does that make it go away?
No.
No.
It doesn't necessarily mean that therapy doesn't look at what's happening.
No, the first view is therapy. It looks at what's happening. Right? And tries to find a way to alleviate it. Either by naming it or, you know, finding a technique that works for it, you know?
And is that so different to meditating?
Yes. In meditation, that is one of the choices you have. You can work that way. And in fact, in the early stages of meditation, that is what you do. But there are also two other techniques that you also do. And one of them is you look at the suffering, but you watch the mind, not the suffering. You have a subject and an object. Don't you? Huh? Number one, you're working with the object. Right. Number two, you're working with the subject.
Okay.
So it's really quite different. I mean, yes, you're right. It's just a different view of the same phenomena. But that just is a pretty big change. It really is. It really is a quality change occurs there. I think that would be wonderful. I'd love to be there. Let's see.
Like you will be.
Any other questions about that? Yes?
Just briefly, when you were differentiating between subject and object, I have done quite a bit of therapy one way or another, and one of the things, one of the ways in which I worked is to come back to how am I being? So it has been object-based. Do you know what I mean? Like, what is it in either kind of my belief about myself or my lack of boundaries that has caused me to respond to this situation?
Yeah.
So it's not about... That situation is a gift for me to then work with and actually see how am I not whole.
Yeah,
this.
That's
how can
right.
I become whole so that I can allow that
yeah.
to be.
That's
and
wonderful.
Say, fine, you stand there, and I'm going to try and stay in my own space
yeah.
for that. I don't want to come in there and change you or whatever.
That's
so
right.
So it has been subject based.
Yeah, that's lovely. That's lovely. Excellent work you've done too.
Thank you.
No, really, that is like that's really the cream of the therapy work, isn't it? And it's really clear, it really is, makes one feel wholesome and powerful in one's life, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's about reclaiming.
Yeah, reclaiming the self. I'm going to say, though, there is still a difference between what I'm saying. No, wait a minute. What I'm saying about number two, when you start to look directly at the subject, you're looking at the subject and saying, oh, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. You're not saying, yeah, I am capable, I am capable. You're saying, oh, capable may be there, but that's not what it is either. That's not what it is. So the first stages are that feeling powerful and feeling whole and understanding cause and effect and realizing that there are many causes and effects and that the self does not have to be subject, right? And then having established that healthy self, then you start taking it apart. So it's a little more. And it's very hard to describe it. I hope you forgive me for this, because it's very difficult to put these things into word because they're process. But you cannot actually meditate unless you have a good, strong, healthy ego. You cannot actually meditate. You need a really good, flexible, strong ego capable of examining things as they are before you can start trying to look at what is a self. So you have to have somehow resolved the fears and the terrors of the psyche so that you're not undermined by your own sense of being. And I think you've done excellent work, you know. And in my experience, if the meditation process is properly attended, that is one of the things that occurs in the process. It should do. If there are difficulties in the psyche, they should emerge in the beginning of the meditation. If they don't, if they go on longer, then as the psyche starts to get into more and more powerful ground, then sometime or other there's going to be really inappropriate stresses and cracking. And it does happen. I hope I'm not betraying any confidence, but I'll tell you some statistics. I have a bit of a reputation in North America for being able to work with people who freak out when they're meditating. You know, they phone me and come and work with me around. So a group of people in Canada who would really are interested in having me live in their city made me an offer I couldn't refuse. Because I move around all the time, they said that they would start a house where people could come and work with me, and they wouldn't charge the people who had freaked out like that. Because I don't have one place, so people sometimes have to follow me across Canada or stuff, which isn't really easy to do if you're finding it difficult to walk through a door or something, you know. And if you're really in a great deal of anxiety or fear, despair, depression, etc., it's very hard to hold down a job, isn't it? You know, like, there isn't just really a lot of room for that in the marketplace, right? So you usually don't have much money. Your circumstances aren't good, and so forth. So these people in Ottawa, they said that they'd like to set up a house and I could come there. If I would come there, every year that they would have this house where people who had experienced difficulty, particularly meditators, could come and they could pay whatever they could. If they could pay nothing, that's fine. And, they would be supported and fed and so forth, and I could work with them there. So I said, of course, I'd be glad to come for 3 months a year. They said 6 months. I said 4 months. They said 6 months. So I would spend 6 months for a period of years in Ottawa. Now, in the process of setting up this house, they sent out questionnaires to all the retreat centers they could find in North America, States and Canada, Christian, Buddhist, yoga, whatever type, okay? There were roughly 1,400 such centers. They sent out a questionnaire asking about the membership, asking about giving a sort of a background about when people who are meditators experience difficulty in meditation, when they if it's in a retreat, it's an unsuitable time to work with them. And so there isn't really a proper conditions to work with them there. And if it's and if they go to the medical profession, quite often they're not met with a lot of understanding when they say this happened to them when they were meditating. Like they might find themselves given lithium or something or shock treatment, right? Do you understand that there's in a really difficult place? And had people had that experience at their meditation center, and would they find use for a facility such as this group was proposing? And how many people, roughly, per year fell into that situation? Is that clear? Mm-hmm. Those three questions were the questions. They sent out approximately 1,400 questionnaires. They got 15% back. So I'm told by my friends who are into statistics that that's a very good return. I'm told that if you get 12%, you consider you've done something really right. Of just that 15% in approximately 1,400 meditation centers in North America, just 15% of them said that they could send or recommend 700 people a year. 700 people a year. Isn't that curious? I had no idea. So there is a real need for you to make sure when you're working with meditation that your meditation teacher knows something about the kind of results that can arise. Don't you agree? It's your consciousness. I hope you agree. There is a real need to be absolutely aware of the danger of meditating meditation techniques and applying them without some clear understanding, either by your teacher or by yourself, hopefully by both, about what those techniques will do and why you're choosing that exercise. That's clear, isn't it? That's an awful lot of people out of 15% only. That's a lot of people. In my estimation, most of those people run into danger because when they're meditating, they're trying to get away from their bodies or change something about their bodies instead of seeing what is there first. Because most people have a very subtle sense of hatred about themselves. Have you noticed that? So when you meditate, you sit down to meditate, and the motive for your meditation, like if you decide you're going to go to heaven because you can't stand your body, that motive gets magnified. So at some point or other in your meditation, you're going to get that hatred back. So you don't want to cause problems for yourself already. I don't know, but I've found a lot of that. People who meditate to get away. Have you? Do you know what I'm saying? Get away from something. You can't get away from something. You can get in touch with something and it will change itself. The minute you become aware, just let yourself be aware of the situation and that as it is, it begins to change. If you keep trying to say, oh, I wish it was different, you don't give it the room to change. You have to go in and feel it as it is and open to it. On its own, it will change. And it will always change for the better because your inherent being knows the awakening. You are not separate from awakening. You have what is called bodhicitta, the mind of discovery, the mind of awakening. You know, in Buddhism, the belief is that it is ignorance that is the enemy. Either willful or unwillful ignoring. What you're trying to ignore, what you wish not to see, either willful or unwillful, that is the great cause of suffering. So in that way, to focus on what it is that makes you unhappy, yes, does alleviate the pain. Yes, does cause greater ease. Yes, does do that, gives you more skill in life. That's true. But there's a difference between more skill in life and being able to utilize what is for the sake of all beings. I think so. What do you think? Vacuum land.
But can I just ask something? It almost sounds like if you lay in the meditation for the crisis in those cases, that you know, if somebody was unstable, they would try to meditate. They couldn't that be the occurrence for 700 people?
I don't think for 700. I think for a certain percentage of them. I think a lot of it is a lack of skill in being able to recognize when someone is not in touch with their body. See, if you're going to do the classical meditation on satipatthana, do you know that satipatthana? That means the four foundations of mindfulness, which you do by watching the breath. The first one is awareness of the body. If you're going to do the Tibetan practice, you start with prostrations, that is to say, with a whole bodily awareness meditation. And if you're ordained as a Buddhist monk, I have to talk only about monks, because there aren't any nuns in the Theravadan countries. Oh, did I say that? Yes, I did. Maybe some other planet, some other lifetime. But in this lifetime, this planet, there's not really any many nuns. There's a few hanging in there. The first meditation you're generally given when you're ordained as a novice is on the 32 parts of the body. And you do that for a long time. You really practice seeing bones, flesh, skin, all hair of the body, hair of the head, bone, ati, mun, samtaju, so forth. The whole. Kesa loma nakadanta tajo mansam naharu ati ati manjam makam hadiyam yakanam kiloma kam piyakam papasama kramang tagunam udariyam karisam pitam semham pubolo hiram sedo medo asu wasa kelo and sing hanika lasaka mutan di. That's what you do. And you really work with it and you feel it at the same time. You feel it in your body and you work with it and work with it and work with it. If you go through the classical training. But when we bring these meditations to the West, we don't often do those basic practices. And we don't even notice we don't do them. Because what do you guys know about the 32 parts of the body? Probably never heard of it until tonight, most of you. Have you? So there's a whole tradition already living in a monastery and getting a certain kind of standard ideas and practices going. After you do the 32 parts like that in your body, then you practice taking them out and putting 32 piles and running, you know? That's a lot of fun, actually. It's the quickest diet I know. Much better than Weight Watchers. What? The best way to do it is bones, flesh, skin. skin, flesh, bones. That's the short form. I quite often give that to people who I think have some promise. Some of them actually do it. I figure that they probably have minds that will jump around too much, so I give it to them a piece at a time. If I give them too many, they'll have too much to worry about, so just give them one.
So do you think they feel like some standard meditations, for example, TM, which is mantra meditation, are not really suitable for
this? Sure, I'm not saying anything like that. I'm saying that in order to safeguard yourself, you are meant, you are built, you are made in a way that is absolutely impeccable. The universe has not made any mistakes. Not one. Everything about you is designed for success. Start by looking at the physical. Don't go to university before you've gone to kindergarten. If you will really pay attention to your own being, whether you're doing therapy or meditation, you will iron out all of your beliefs and ideas and cleanse yourself of the views that don't allow you to see that the universe has not made a mistake. So the best way to start doing that is to work with the body. And if you really do that, if you would really work with that, just imaging bones, 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 you say ati, 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 you visualize your skull, ati, try it, let's do it, ati, or bones, whatever you want to, just say bones. And use your hands a little bit and feel your skull, ati, and try to feel how the bones connect, bones, bones, say the word. Bones, bones, feel where your skull is. Can you feel the different plates in your skull? Can you feel, what is it called, those little, the sutures, yeah. I'm glad I brought you. Can you feel them all? Can you move the different plates of your skull? You know you actually can?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I need it. Bones, 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 bones. Really feel your whole skull, bones. Bones, bones. Feel how your jaw connects there. Bones, 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 bones. And down your vertebrae, your neck. Bones, bones. So, like, how do your shoulder blades hold on there? Bones. Bones, your rib cage, collarbone. Bones, bones. Bones. Bones, bones, bones. Feel your vertebrae down your back. Bones, bones. Can you really feel how your pelvis hooks in? Bones. Does one side of your pelvis feel bigger than the other? Bones, bones, bones. Bones, bones. Does it? Isn't that curious? Bones, down your legs, bones. The longest bone in your body is from your hip to your knee, and it's got a tunnel right down the middle. Bones, bones. Both the two bones that go down your from your knee to your ankle. Bones, bones, bones. And then that from the shoulder to the elbow, both arms together. Bones. Then from the elbow to the hand, to the wrist. Bones, bones. How does your elbow work? How does that twist around? Bones, bones. Your hands and your feet together. Bones. Now that's a mouthful. Bones, bones. Awful lot of bones in there, eh? Bones. Feet. Then you go back to your head, flesh, see the brain, all the muscles in the face, brain, flesh, eyeballs, little spiral nerves going back from the eyeballs. What's inside your earlobes, your tongue, sinuses. This is all cartilage here, you know. This isn't bone. Flesh, flesh. The muscles that hold your neck. Flesh, flesh, flesh. Down your neck, the muscles, the blood vessels. Flesh. Flesh, all the muscles across your back. Flesh, liver on the right, spleen on the left. Flesh, isn't that right? It isn't my body. And down into the intestine. You can throw the gallbladder in there too if you want. Flesh, flesh, moving down the intestines, the kidneys in the back there. Flesh. Flesh, all the intestines nestled in the pelvic bowl. Just feel it, feel it. Flesh, genitals, buttocks, flesh, all the muscles through the buttocks, down through the legs, flesh, flesh. The knees to the ankles, flesh, flesh. You're noticing, does one side feel larger or smaller than the other? One side feels slightly detached. If you do it with real seriousness, you'd be surprised at what you feel. Then you start again, skin, skin, and you just do the three-dimensional bubble of your skin. Yourself like a three-dimensional balloon. Skin, move down past the head, the hair. Neck, skin, skin. Down over the shoulders. The trunk of the body. Skin, skin. Skin down right to the trunk, and then down to do the legs and the arms together, from the hips to the knees and the shoulders to the elbows together. Skin, skin, skin. Knees to ankles and elbows to wrists together. Skin, skin, skin. Hands and feet, skin. And then you go back, skin, and you just feel your skin very quickly. Flesh, and you just image your flesh really quickly. Bones, and you do that. Right? So that's how the classical meditation, that's the short form of the 32 parts of the body, that's how it starts. Now if you could imagine paying attention to that for a minimum of 3 or 4 hours a day, every day for 6 or 8 months, you can see that will give you quite a different kind of grounding, wouldn't it, in your body. So when you were watching the breath, you would have a sense of yourself breathing here, but your whole body present while you were doing it. You wouldn't be surprised if some area of your body felt a little out of joint suddenly, or you had a sense of swelling or decreasing, right? Wouldn't make you feel fearful, because you'd have a sense of your body. So when piti or various different experiences of meditation arose, it would be quite fine, because the sense of bones, flesh, skin would already have established a kind of security about the physical. You would realize that it feels different ways at different times. You would have been meditating one time on bones, flesh, skin and had the distinct feeling that this hand was totally turned around. When you looked, you saw it wasn't, but it felt like it was. You would be used to that. Do you understand? There would be a really strong sense of that. So one day when you're meditating off somewhere and you get into a really strong sense of almost detached from the body and you suddenly feel like your arm is twisted around, you wouldn't freak out. But if you have not got that grounding, you can freak out. Does that answer you? I think it's because we misunderstand the importance of those basic steps. We grasp the philosophical application, and a lot of the teachers that have brought this, probably myself included, that have brought these teachings because of having worked with teachers and having had some success with the meditation practices, are already pretty healthy ego structures. You know? And they go through the pain, but they do it so quickly, and then they, you know, they just teach what seems like to them the directest path. I know several teachers who are really skilled and really aware, but they're not necessarily aware of what the people who are learning from them are going to do with what they're taught. Does that make sense? So I think that if you're going to teach or you're going to learn meditation in the East and you don't want to have a lot of stuff shock you and do something so unskillful as go mad for, you know, 5 seconds, 5 minutes, 5 hours, 5 days, or 5 years. I mean, how unskillful, my dear. Oh, tichika, tichika. You know, and you don't want to do that, then it's a good idea to spend a little time being aware of the body. And I don't mean yoga. I mean meditation on how your body feels. Yes?
How is what you're talking about different to, say, Vipassana? I don't know how the term is used, but the Vipassana that I've been taught is starting at the top of the body.
Doing scan. Yeah.
How is that different?
Yeah, that's really excellent. Now, not all people who teach Vipassana do that. Yeah. Yeah, that's like, yeah, scanning the body. That's awareness of the body. That's the first stage of the. There is this teaching in Buddhism called the Satipatthana Sutta. There's a long and the short sutra teaching on how to meditate on the breath, awareness of the breath. And it has four main parts, four foundations of mindfulness. The first one is awareness of the body. The usual way it is taught is by watching the breath and then scanning the body. Watching the breath and then scanning the body. Watching the breath and then scanning the body. Yeah. Now, it isn't always taught that way. In the West, I find it isn't always taught that way, is it? No. And very often not taught that way. But, so you happen to have a teacher who does teach it that way. Now, there are a lot of different ways of teaching meditation on the breath. Unfortunately, they're all called Vipassana.
Yeah.
So you see, there's some real... We really have some educating to do, don't we? Like, you should ask questions, you know, when you meet a meditation teacher or when you are approaching this. You should ask questions. You should try to understand a bit about the process. You should know what you want to do with it, too. Like, maybe you want to win a lottery. So you keep asking a meditation teacher until you find one who knows how to win lotteries. And once you do that, you probably have the faith to do something else, you know? And the time. What, faith and time? Yeah, faith and time are definitely the quick path. So I'd like some questions now about what you'd like me to talk about, seeing as I finished saying what I wanted to blah, blah, blah. Yes?
You just mentioned that you said when you were working with how the body's put together that you don't mean yoga. No? Is it possible to use Hatha yoga as, it is a meditation of the body, so what's the sort of difference?
Because Hatha yoga is putting the body in a position. Who did that? What can I say? Thank you.
Did you get my good side?
Did you get my good side? I don't have a good side. What you see is what you get. It's all the same from every side. Hatha yoga is still putting the body in a position, not checking what is.
But shouldn't it be? I mean, I feel it should be. That if you're in any position and you're meditating on the body, you're checking on what is.
Do you think that everybody who does yoga does that? I don't. I think a lot of people who do yoga aren't. Watch out. Here I go again. Are control freaks.
Yeah.
I'm smiling sweetly so nobody will pick on me.
You were wondering what those ropes were for.
What's true though, isn't it? Yes.
I had a common disorder that you found in your house in Ottawa. People who freak out.
It's just starting this year. But the people that I work with often, like anxiety, inability to sleep at night, worry, crying, depression, people that I've worked with.
So basically, you would correct what's been done wrong with them through the manipulation process?
No, I don't. What I do is I try to bring their focus into the body, and the body is itself the corrective. Because this is home. And people just have to come home. The body is a refuge. Or it should be. It should be a refuge. If it isn't a refuge, it's because you got too many ghosts in the closet, so you got to let them out. And how you let them out is by going in. Because there's not room for both of you, so they leave. And that's basically how it works. You don't have to be angry, you don't have to be forceful, you just have to gently come into your body and the unfinished business of the past will leave. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but basically that's how it works. It really is true that you are a really good model. You've been safety tested for a long, long time. There's no warranty on how long you will last, but you're guaranteed for success. Time is questionable, but the model is perfect. Isn't that reassuring? There's nothing wrong with you. Yes?
A good way to go. Brilliant.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. Usually when there's an illness, there's a lot of tension or holding around it, and that probably restricts to some degree whatever healing or whatever releasing can happen. So it's absolutely... Do you find that in your work?
I do.
I would think that would be the most direct, powerful way to go. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't like using white light, though.
No.
Because it's so harsh for a lot of people. But there are some beautiful different ways of working with light, which I'm sure you've discovered in your work, because you do lovely work. Yeah. And there are wonderful ways to approach it. But is there anything more important than attitude? I don't think so.
So what about dough? Using the dough in?
No.
So lack of pressure is, let's say, the yang process coming back to your body, is actually massaging the whole body.
And anything that you do, any massage, anything that you do, it's all wonderful, especially if your attitude is one of exploration of something that is fine. You're looking for the health. You know the illness is there. You're looking for the health. And when you run across a patch of illness, you try to see how it fits. If your hand feels like it's upside down, you're just really curious. Oh, isn't that interesting? As soon as you get too corrective, there's going to be subtle hatred in there. I'm going to fix it, but it's you. Yes?
Given meditations about sort of looking at the reality of things, say, do you think there's some technique experience, and they feel repressed. I know people who I know who are heavy meditators or have done a lot of meditation, when actually I thought meditation was meant to get rid of those repressions. Do you think there are any techniques or any types of people or types of attitude that actually help the repressions in a way, you know, help repress things more?
You mean, I'm sorry, not quite sure. Are you saying some people who are repressed have already used meditation to become more repressed? No.
Yeah, I guess that I'm wondering if that's a possibility. Or if it's a
I think so.
You point towards the meditation that you can actually think that you're unrepressing yourself within.
Yeah, I think so. I know people that have done that.
So what do you think the sort of how they manage to do that through?
Again, like a fear, you know, there's a fear of something in the body.
So they're actually doing it like an ego device of a meditator.
Or maybe perfectionism, you know, I'm really going to do this right. I'm right and they're wrong. It's usually kind of a very, kind of, see, the difference between somebody who goes off and does their own work and somebody who goes off and does their own work is what I'm pointing at. There are people who go off and do their own work because they really want to work deeply and intimately. There are people who go off and do their own work because they know they're right and they're afraid somebody might interfere. And fear is what I'm looking at. It is the fear. One is motivated by love, the other is motivated by fear. So it can look the same. Like, I'm going to go and do my meditation to see things as they are, as long as it conforms with what I want to see. The nice thing about that is that those people will find out for themselves, because cause and effect is a real law. It might be her daughters. So, does that do? Is that anywhere near what you're asking me about?
Yeah, I was just sort of an observation of some people.
You've seen that.
Really,
yeah.
Actually,
yeah. I have been familiar with because of my age and the good fortune I had of meeting Buddhism when I did, and then going to the East, I have been a peer of quite a few of the people who are well-known teachers in North America, and I have been very familiar with their struggles at various times. And a couple of them, like, for example, became very, very celibate very early in their career, huh? Because they were... And then... And then they get into a position where they're teaching. Well, sometimes when you're teaching, those people out there are not very nice. You know? Like, I got news for you folks. It's not all great on this side of your faces. You know, sometimes it isn't. You know, I've watched young girls come and sit cross-legged in front of male teachers with short skirts and no pants on, looking all spiritual, like from the back, you know. I've watched all kinds of things like that happen. There's a point where your own fear goes whoop, you know. So you got it. You really have to be honest, I think, you know. You really have to be able to name your own fear and trust yourself to be vulnerable. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't think there's any substitute for that vulnerability, do you? I don't think there is. Because everything else is going to get you anyway. You know, cause and effect really is true. If you're caught in a subtle fear-hate state, it's going to come up one way or the other. So you can manipulate and maneuver around it here, there, this, that, and the other way. You're good at politics. You always can keep everything at your distance. But sometime or other, the strain of the polarity of your own consciousness is going to crack. And it's better if it does it sooner, because the tension isn't so great and it doesn't splatter so much. But having said that, I will also say this, that if you have a lot of fear of sensuality or, say you were subject to a lot of anger and abuse when you were a child, and so those fears remain in your consciousness, fear of authority or whatever, huh? Like da-di-da-di-da. And then you go off to a retreat center and you meditate. And you are the kind of meditator that it's possible for you to experience bliss. In what's called jhana. Do you know that word, jhana? It's a state of absorption where temporarily the unwholesome states of consciousness are submerged. You could say the mud settles. Still there, but it's settled. In fact, that's how the texts describe it. The mud has settled. So if you shook it up again, it would be back. You know, you haven't got rid of it. You haven't filtered the water. But it's settled. In those states, you can recognize the difference between that and the state of fear. See? So that in that state, you can realize, wait, I don't want to be in that state of fear. And you can begin to make the choices, right, to not do that outside of jhana. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, what they do is they think, oh, why don't I spend all my time? They cling to the highs. And that's what increases the tension. There's no substitute for spiritual friends. Spiritual friends, people you're traveling with who are doing the same work and who recognize how important it is, to be honest. A good spiritual friend will tell you something three times, and if you don't hear it at the third time, then they'll stop telling you. They're not going to nag. They'll just sort of say, by the way, what? Yes?
I wonder if you have any view on Feldenkrais, because it seems to be the sort of body awareness and exploration that you've been talking about, but with a corrective element as well, and trying to get rid of tensions.
It's wonderful work, isn't it? I think it's really wonderful work. Really wonderful. Do you do Feldenkrais? Oh, congratulations, what good livelihood. That's wonderful. Again, it's the motive, isn't it? It's the motive of the person that's doing it. I have a dear friend who does Feldenkrais. The problem with my friend is that they're convinced that Feldenkrais is the answer to everything for everybody all the time. And I keep gently trying to say, you know, some people don't like to be touched. What will we do with them? You know, and other such things. But she almost wrestles people to the ground. And it's because it has been so useful for her, you know, because she knows what it has done for her. So again, there's always that thing of mistaking a technique for the technique. But I think it's wonderful work. Whatever it is that brings you into a state of compassionate, non-clinging awareness is what you want to do. Yes? A gold light is good. What do you use, Jackie? Blue sometimes, eh? Is what? Gold and pink and a moonlight colored light. Moonlight light is beautiful. You know, something softer, milkier. But that kind of diamond white is like fluorescent white, darling. It's just not... It's a little laser quality, you know? Yes? You mean like greed, hatred, and delusion? For starters. Unwholesome energy. So, say you're a child. Let's say you were all children once. Is that okay? Can you all imagine that? That's not too hard, is it? Once upon a time, even I was a child. And, was that your daughter's, by the way?
It was from Namba.
That's lovely. That's lovely. I'm glad you love your children so well. That's good. That's wonderful, darling. No. They're looking at you because you're such a good mother. You're a good yuppie mother. So say as a child you had some experience that overwhelmed you. And so what you do is, because it's overwhelming, the ego consciousness is going to split, the emotion that's coming at you or whatever is so powerful you can't handle it, then you split. And one part of that just sort of stays frozen in the consciousness. And the other part immediately either identifies we'll call it abuser and abused. How's that? Is that okay? I don't want to overwork those terms, but is that all right? Can I use those? One part of that consciousness will identify with either the abuser or the abused, right? Usually the abuser. Because obviously that's the one in power, so that's the way to survive. And so then you survive. And then when it looks like such a situation is going to come up again, this brain recalls the way you survived last time and just triggers into that activity. So then it becomes a really viable form of survival because it's worked twice. So you carry on doing that for a considerable period of time, sometimes lifetimes. Let's say lifetimes. So let's say you're born, whoever made you, that pattern is, looks for another body this lifetime, and here it is. And there is this already this propensity, this desire, to make sure that everything is just so that there isn't a chance that anybody will pick on me. Right? And so let's say we're all sent out to the garden, all us brothers and sisters and cousins, to pick peas in the summer, okay? Because it's time to make dinner and we got to go out to the pea patch and we're picking peas. And say, I'm really the one who was born with this sense of, fear of something being unjust, so I always have to do everything with great deliberation. Say, so I'm really picking the peas carefully because I'm even concerned about the pea plants, you know, and I'm picking them really slowly. And everybody else is getting really, so everybody else's bowl is full, so they all say, oh, you're eating all the peas. No, I'm not, no, I'm not. Overreaction. Didn't even enjoy it. Didn't even eat a pea. They all did. Total negative in all ways. And then for days, feeling hurt and unhappy. That's called unwholesome. I mean, all kinds of things about that are unwholesome, but say that's the sense of being, like one person. It's unwholesome that there would be that kind of comparison in a community. There are all kinds of things that are unwholesome. Unwholesome is basically trying to make things different than they are. That's basically the root of unwholesomeness. Trying for an experience other than that which is present is the basic bottom line, wouldn't you say, for all unwholesomeness? Trying to make things different trying for an experience other than that which is present. Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, basically it is, yeah. Overriding yourself, overriding the other, overriding an experience. To me, the feeling of unwholesome is very clear. It's not a feeling of equal density on both sides of your body. There's like a great unchangeable stillness in watching outside or whatever, you know? Isn't that equal sense of free-flowing possibility on both sides of the body? You know what I mean? That's a real good, strong to me. That's what I watch for in myself. That's when I know that there's unwholesome energy present. Does that make sense to you? Yeah? No. As soon as you're aware, it changes. Because you've given up the stance. But equal density? That equal density is when you're aware that inside your skin, innumerable possibilities are present of who could arise. Outside your skin, innumerable opportunities are present which could be grabbed or not. And it's an equal mystery on both sides. There's no position. There may be desire, but there's no subject and no object. That's wholesome. Because then, you see, you're not separate from anything. So there is a sense of self coming into being at every moment, but not clinging, not fixed. Then it is capable of seeing things as they are, because there isn't a preference or a judgment or a... So that's what I call it. I call it equal density, and it seems to me to explain the feeling of the wholesome mind. Does that sound reasonable? Yes?
Can you say a bit more about what you mean by aspiration? Or aspiration?
Didn't you ask me that before? I thought I heard you ask me that before. Yeah. You see, aspiration is really honestly what you're interested in. What you really, like, you may really honestly be interested in having the winning lottery ticket. Yes, why not? Exactly. So then you would work with that aspiration. Pardon me? No, very often it is just a sense, a feeling, a holding. Very often. Yes. Yeah. Some people feel it directionally, like above or in front or around them. Doesn't matter. It's very personal. You'd be surprised how personal can become the wish for all beings to be free of suffering. Or maybe you wouldn't. I don't think you would, actually. You look like a pretty good group. How are you doing? Is it too warm in here? Is that enough? Oh, that's more than enough. So there's a warm light in your heart, a nice gold light, in your and it spreads through your body in all directions. Pours out through your pores, above, below, in front, behind, right, left, the four quarters. Just spreads out through the universe. This beautiful gold light fills out past this room, spreads everywhere. Wherever there is suffering caused by ignorance, either willful or unwillful, of body, speech, or mind, the gold light just temporarily washes it. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you. Thank you for your compassion.